From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, growing up colored in a small segregated mill town, we talk with Henry Louis Gates, chairman of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. His new memoir, Colored People, spans the 1950s and 60s. Also today we meet Beck, the 23-year-old singer-songwriter with low expectations and a hit song about being a loser. He says he never intended his song Loser to be interpreted as an anthem for slackers. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews MTV's new edition of Unplugged, featuring Tony Bennett. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is due to arrive in Italy later today. He's begun a European tour as part of D-Day observances. He has a series of high-level meetings scheduled along with World War II commemoration ceremonies, Francis Kennedy reports.
Security in the capital has been stepped up dramatically for the visit of President Clinton and his wife Hillary. Tomorrow, Mr. Clinton will meet President Scalfaro before going on to the Vatican for a meeting with the Pope and a visit to the Sistine Chapel. In the afternoon, President Clinton will have his first encounter with the new Prime Minister, media mogul Silvio Berlusconi, and then pay a visit to City Hall, where he's expected to address the people of Rome. Friday morning will be taken up with events to mark the 50th anniversary of the Allied landings at Anzio and Nettuno near Rome. President Clinton's father was stationed in Italy near Naples during the liberation. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
A federal judge says the National Guard must reinstate a colonel who was dismissed because she is a lesbian. Colonel Margareth Kammermeyer was discharged from the Washington State National Guard 2 years ago. Her dismissal came after she acknowledged her sexual orientation. The judge has ruled the government discriminated against her solely because she is homosexual. The judge also said the government failed to show a rational basis for doing so. Kammermeyer was a 26-year career officer who received the Bronze Star for service in Vietnam. Her lawyer says she looks forward to returning to the service. The Utah Valley is cleaning up after hurricane force winds swept through the area yesterday. Wind gusts up to 121 miles per hour blasted the Provo and Salt Lake City region. Meteorologist Len Randolph of KSL Television in Salt Lake City says damage was extensive.
The wind just converted a lot of rain into very cold air, and it ran down. You got to think of it like an air avalanche. The Salt Lake International Airport, at least 12 aircraft were damaged. A high mountain valley community called Heber, not too far from Salt Lake, their airport, several airplanes flipped over by the winds. Rooftops were just knocked off of buildings. We have living monument trees, 100 to 150 feet tall, never to be cut, were destroyed.
At least 15 people were hurt. California Governor Pete Wilson is suing the federal government. He wants the United States to pay the state's medical bills for illegal immigrants. He's seeking nearly $370 million. Wilson says the number of illegal immigrants entering California has triggered a medical crisis in the state. He blames the federal government for not enforcing the nation's immigration laws. He filed a similar lawsuit in April seeking money for imprisoning illegal aliens. A third suit dealing with education is in the works. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 4 points at 3,762. This is NPR. There's been violence in part of the occupied West Bank, still controlled by Israel. Soldiers wounded 17 Palestinian protesters today who had attacked an Israeli police station in Ramallah. Israeli Army sources told the Associated Press soldiers responded with tear gas and rubber bullets, but emergency room doctors at Ramallah Hospital say some of the victims were hit with live ammunition. It's one of the worst outbreaks of violence since Palestinian self-rule started last month. The National Right to Life Committee and several other anti-abortion groups say they're going to boycott products made by companies linked to the abortion pill RU486, but they still haven't decided exactly which products will be on their list. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The groups, including the Christian Coalition and Concerned Women for America, say the boycott will be a sign that their movement isn't dead, despite some recent setbacks. Last month, Roussel-Youcleff, the French firm that makes the abortion pill, announced that it was donating its patent to a U.S. research group, clearing the way for testing in the U.S. Richard Glasow with the Right to Life Committee says despite the transfer of the patent, anti-abortion groups are still targeting the French firm and its German parent company, chemical maker Hoechst AG.
We're boycotting them because they sent the abortion pill here. If they pulled it back and stopped it being used here, then there wouldn't be any point in us boycotting them, would there?
The anti-abortion groups hope that even if testing goes ahead, their boycott will succeed in scaring off possible U.S. manufacturers for RU486. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Negotiators for the United Steelworkers Union and LTV Steel Company have reached a tentative contract. A union official says both sides had talked for some 36 hours straight. A committee of local presidents approved the agreement. A spokesman for LTV says he has no details about the terms of the accord. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Henry Louis Gates has written a new memoir that addresses many racial issues from a very personal perspective. His book, Colored People, is a memoir about growing up in Piedmont, West Virginia in the 1950s and 60s. Gates writes that he wants to evoke a colored world of the 50s, a Negro world of the early 60s, and the advent of a black world later in the 60s. Gates is chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. He's written extensively about African and African-American literature and about race in America. His essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and its book review section. When Gates was born in 1950, Piedmont was a segregated mill town with a population of about 2,500 people, 350 of whom were African-American. Like just about all the black men in town, Gates' father worked at the paper mill. He worked a second job at night.
He would work from 6:30 in the morning until 3:30 p.m. on the day shift. Come home, he would bathe. School let out at 3:30. And then he would go to his second job as a janitor at the telephone company at 4:30. And he worked there until 7:30. And this second job gave us an edge, you know, the margin of difference from most of the other black people in town. And my mother was a wizard at financial management. She always seemed to have enough money for everything. And she was very careful to dress my brother and me in ways that she would have found elegant. She was a very beautiful, elegant person with a great sense of style. And the reason that she did that was so that no white racist could look at us and say that we were dirty or unkempt. She was obsessed by how we looked in public around white people, because white people said that we were dirty, white people said that we smelled bad, white people said that we didn't know how to dress, that we didn't have a sense of subtle taste, et cetera, et cetera. So much of our early lessons from my mother after reading and writing were in grooming and in public appearance and in public presence.
When you went to elementary school, you went to a newly integrated school. This is the mid-1950s. What mm-hmm. was your family's attitude toward you going to a school that had just... Were they pleased about that, or were they afraid for you, or were they thinking that you were entering a world that they would never be a part of in the way you'd be a part of it?
They were very excited about it, but they were wary. They were nervous about it. They wanted to protect us. My mother would ask me every day when I got home, who had said what to whom? What did the teachers say? How were they treating you? Any sort of ironic remark I would make, she would grill me about it. I mean, what did the teacher mean? Mm-hmm. What was the expression on her face? What was the timbre and tone of her voice? And it was only, and I thought my mother just was obsessed with detail. It was only later that I realized that she was trying to be a fly on the wall, a set of eyes in the classroom to make sure that her two boys were being properly treated, because she had no idea. My mother had lots of experiences with white people, but in a servant's position. I mean, as a girl, she had cleaned the house of, as I write in the book, of the Thomas family. And she had been horribly treated by the woman who owned the house. And she was wary of white people. More than wary, she despised white people. And so she was excited about the possibilities that integration opened. She wanted both of her boys to be doctors. My brother is a very successful oral surgeon in New York City. And she wanted me to be a doctor, and I wanted to be a doctor too. And she thought that this would be a great route through this integrated school system and that we would end up very successful people. But she also knew that there were great dangers, and we were warned not to dance with white kids, not to ask them to go out, not to socialize with white kids. We would get in serious trouble if we attempted to do that.
You write a little bit in your memoir, Colored People, about what it was like when Central High School in Little Rock was integrated. And I'd like you to read that passage for us.
Okay, let me see if I can find that here. Yeah, I remember this because we watched it on TV every night. It was like watching the Knicks and the Bulls or something. It was we were glued to this television set. And that, of course, too, I think many of us forget that the preeminence of the news in our lives is coterminous in this country with the civil rights era, that news became increasingly important because they had an event that they could film every day. And that event, of course, was the civil rights struggle. In 1957, when I was in second grade, black children integrated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. We watched it on TV. All of us watched it. I don't mean Mama and Daddy and Rocky. I mean all the colored people in America watched it together with one set of eyes. We'd watch it in the morning on the Today Show on NBC before we'd go to school. We'd watch it in the evening on the news with Edward R. Murrow on CBS. We'd watch the special bulletins at night interrupting our TV shows. The children were all well-scrubbed and greased down, as we'd say, hair short and closely cropped, parted and oiled, the boys, done in a permanent and straightened with turned-up bangs and curls, the girls, starched shirts, white, and creased pants, shoes shining like a buck private spit shine. Those Negroes were clean. The fact was, those children trying to get the right to enter that school in Little Rock looked like black versions of models out of Jack and Jill magazine, to which my mama had subscribed so that I could see what children outside the valley were up to. They handpicked those children, Daddy would say. No dummies, no nappy heads, heads not too kinky, lips not too thick, no disses and no debts. At 7, I was dismayed by Daddy's cynicism. It bothered me somehow that those children would have been chosen rather than just having shown up or volunteered or been nearby in the neighborhood. Daddy was jaundiced about the civil rights movement and especially about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He'd say all of his names to drag out his scorn. By the mid-60s, we'd argue about Dr. King from sunup to sundown. Sometimes he'd just mention King to get a rise from me, to make a sagging evening more interesting, to see if I had learned anything real yet, to see how long I could think up counter-arguments before getting so mad that my face would turn purple. I think he just liked the color purple on my face, liked producing it there. But he was not of two minds about those children in Little Rock.
Did you share any of your father's cynicism about Martin Luther King or the civil rights movement?
I thought Martin Luther King was the greatest person I'd ever seen. I'd never seen him, a public figure speak who could give you goose flesh. Lord knows that Reverend Monroe in the Walden Methodist Church wasn't passing out too much goose flesh in his weekly sermons. And that was about the only opportunity that I had to see a black person speak in public, except for my mother, who would read the eulogies at all the colored people's funerals. And she, of course, was a great orator, but that's very different than seeing someone on TV giving a speech about the right of black children to integrate a school system or the right of black passengers to sit down on buses in Birmingham.
The fact that you were the first generation to go to an integrated school, did that create any kind of generational gap with your parents' generation?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the way that we see the world is completely different. The way that my brother and I see the world is completely different. My brother started school in the segregated school, mm-hmm. and he was born in 1945. And the differences in opportunities that we had, for example, is very, very different. He went to West Virginia University after going to junior college, Potomac State College, for 2 years, and then he went on to West Virginia University Dental School. If he had been 6 years later, like I was, he would have gone to Yale, too, or Harvard, or wherever. Those opportunities weren't open. Harvard and Yale had very strict quotas on blacks until 1968 and then 1969, and I happened to end up at Yale in 1969. So that I'm an affirmative action baby, to quote Steve Carter. Though my spin on that, I think, is a little bit different than my friend Steve Carter's.
What was it like starting to learn about the Black Consciousness Movement in a small rural community?
Oh, it was exciting. It was It was so exciting. But that was the dividing line. That was BC and AD and race relations in this town and within our own family. For instance, I remember growing an afro. First, when I saw an afro, I couldn't believe it. I mean, all this hair. And I'd been fascinated by natural hairstyles since I saw Odetta for the first time, I think, in the late 50s. And then when I saw Cicely Tyson on East Side, West Side. Remember Cicely Tyson?
Yes, yeah.
And she had a short natural, and I remember thinking it was so strange. And the black people would sit around in front of TV and say, why don't that girl get her hair done? You know, what's wrong with Odetta? She needs to go to the beauty parlor. And I was fascinated by how bold Odetta was. I mean, to risk, I knew that if the people in my living room were saying this, people all over colored living rooms were saying this, and to say, I have my own aesthetic. And then I started reading Malcolm X, and I started reading Malcolm X because I read it, a profile with Kareem, well, then Lew Alcindor, but now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was a hero of mine. And he said, every Negro should read the autobiography of Malcolm X. So I ordered it from Red Bull's newsstand, and I read it, and I gave it to my father, and we argued about it, and it was exciting. And Malcolm was saying, we have to get all this grease out of your hair and stop processing your hair. And my cousin Gary, and the Coleman side of the family, started calling me Malcolm and Stokely when I was about 15. And he did it with, he still calls me that, and he did it with scorn in 1965, and he does it with scorn 30 years later. It was a threat. They would say, look, the white people here treat us pretty good, so why don't we just not make too many waves, and everything will be okay. Because essentially these people were fairly well paid. Eventually, when racism relaxed, they were able to own their own homes. Many now own two homes, one over in the country, on the river.
So you were seen as maybe rocking the boat and making it hard for other black people in the community.
Right. There was a mixed set of responses. Pride, I think, on the one hand, but also fear and anxiety on the other. Mm-hmm. Now, I was not alone. I had my three closest friends by my junior year were three black guys, and we called ourselves the Fearsome Foursome, Roland Fisher and Jerry Price and Rodney Galloway. And we were hell, I tell you that. We had Roland Fisher had a 1959 Chrysler with those big tail fins, and it was a convertible car. We had to use black masking tape to keep the snow and the rain from coming in, and we'd tool around in that car driving back and forth to Kaiser, the county seat 5 miles away. But we would read books together, like Malcolm X or Man-Child in the Promised Land or Soul on Ice. 1968 was the beginning of that was our senior year. And Soul on Ice came out in 68. We ate those books up, and we would talk about them. And I joined the Record Club of America so we could get black music. I remember, of course, we bought Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye and the Supremes and the Four Tops. But I got into jazz through my Uncle Erky, who was this expert on jazz. And he would tell me things and, you know, how I should be listening to this and listening to that, and I would order these albums. And so I read this article in Ebony about John Coltrane, and I looked in the Record Club of America catalog under Coltrane, and there was an album called Expression. So I ordered it, and the album came, and the Fearsome Foursome was gathered in my bedroom where we would hang out and listen to the music on my stereo. And I put Expression on, and I never forget this. Jerry Price, whom we called Soul Mo, because he was so much into soul music and the blues, looked at me after we'd listened to this thing for about 60 seconds, and he said, you got to send it back, brother. The thing is defective. Because we had no more idea of how we were supposed to listen to this thing. And I looked at Roland and I looked at Rodney and I said, what do you guys think? They said, there's something wrong with it, man. The thing wasn't mixed right. You got to send it back. You can't dance to that. And so, but I had a feeling that something was happening here that was not exactly clear, as the song said, and that we were not yet able to listen to it. We weren't literate in what Coltrane was trying to do. Eventually, of course, we became literate.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. His new memoir is called Colored People. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department and author of the new memoir, Colored People. When you were 12, your mother went through menopause and at that time became very deeply depressed. And that was a devastating experience for you. You describe it as the crossroads of your childhood. Mm. And about that time, you also joined the church, the Methodist Church. This was in the early 1960s. And I guess there was a connection between the two. And you were very deeply immersed in the church for a couple of years. I guess what I wanted to ask you is this. You said that after you were saved, you worried that one day you'd open your mouth and somebody else's voice would come out as the Spirit possessed you to do its bidding, and you didn't want to be controlled by a heavenly remote. I was wondering what you'd witnessed in church that gave you this kind of fear.
Well, people talked in tongues all the time. People would be possessed of the Spirit, and a sign that you were saved for many people, and indeed for many of the people in our church, the ultimate sign that you were saved was the capacity to talk in tongues, to speak in a language that only God understood. And it could happen at any time. It was like a bolt of lightning. I mean, you'd be sitting there listening to the sermon, and people would be sort of feeling the Spirit, and someone would break out in this unknown tongue. And I was not interested in that happening, quite frankly. I also was afraid that one night I would be awakened in the middle of the night and have a visitation from an angel, or see strange writing on the wall like the scene from the Bible, and then I would be compelled to do something that God wanted me to do, which would probably cause great pain and sacrifice. And Miss Sarah, who was a wonderful person, I write about her, and I hope lovingly, I found her very amusing. She was, you could talk about the Father, you could talk about the Son, but Miss Sarah was on first-name basis with the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost, you see, the fire of Pentecost, the Spirit of life and living and salvation itself, this was what the black people in my church were fascinated with. The resurrection, that was okay. Virgin birth, that was okay. The fishes and the loaves, water into wine. But this visitation of the Holy Spirit was what the passion of Christianity was all about for my people. And that was a passion that I never had privy to. I always marveled at it. I was interested in it. I remember when Vic Clay, who was a very good friend of my brother's, went to the Holiness Church across the street for a convocation, as they're called, which was sort of all the churches in this region would come together, and they'd have great preaching and great singing. It was a real cultural event over a weekend. And he was just got up to walk out of the church, and he told us later he just felt the Spirit hit him as he reached to open the door. It turned him around, forced him back to the altar. He found himself on his knees confessing all of his sins. And I did not want to undergo that kind of experience. I always wanted to be in control. I never lost a sense of double consciousness, as Du Bois would put it, a sense of sort of being in the church, but also watching everybody be in the church. I didn't want to be taken over by another consciousness.
In some of your recent essays, you've been writing about the politics of identity and the extremes that that's taken some people to. And I guess I'm really interested in hearing some of your impressions on the issue on whether there is a growing anti-Semitism in parts of the black community. This is something you've been writing about since a couple of years ago. In an op-ed piece that you wrote in the New York Times a couple of years ago, you wrote that you're seeing a new kind of anti-Semitism. And I wonder what you think is new about it. What's different?
Well, to answer your first question, the recent statistics suggest that blacks are twice as likely as their white counterparts, their WASP counterparts, to be anti-Semitic. And that's very bothersome if you're an African-American intellectual. Many African-American intellectuals have been concerned with this, particularly people like Patricia Williams and bell hooks and Cornel West. Lord knows Cornell's written and spoken about this extensively, and I think has just completed a book about it. But we're equally concerned about homophobia in the black community, misogyny in the black community, the scapegoating of other ethnic groups in the black community. And the reason we're concerned is not so much for these groups, not so much for the Jewish community or for the Korean community or for the gay community, but for ourselves, for our own people, that we, if we give in to this temptation to scapegoat, we lose sight of the real causes of poverty, the real causes of the affliction that has torn the black community into two distinct communities, the haves and the have-nots. And that's what's worrisome about it. And I think that what we're seeing when we see black students on campus stand and applaud the most outrageous claims from demagogues, I mean black middle-class intellectuals, is the growing frustration that many of us have with the continued and indeed increasing poverty that's afflicting the black community. People feel so desperate. We have the guilt of the survivor, many of us in the intellectual class. We feel guilty about all those that we left behind. You see, a peculiar thing happened with the culmination of the Civil Rights Movement in 1964 or 65, the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. White America opened its doors for some of us who were poised by hook or crook to rush through those previously locked gates and enter the larger white middle class. That situation obtained for a few years, and then, of course, there was a reaction. The doors slammed shut, and many black people were left behind. Entitlement programs were cut back. Affirmative action programs were challenged in the courts. Head Start was cut back under a series of Republican administrations, and it left behind quite a lot of people.
I have one last question for you. After having written your memoir about coming of age in the 1950s and 1960s in a small rural town in West Virginia, do you have a sense of what it was in your childhood that kind of prepared you most for being a public intellectual and for expressing opinions sometimes that don't fit in with the majority opinion? And, you know, for leading a life of the mind.
My mother and my father. There's no question about that. I tried to capture in this book my father's stories in my mother's voice. My mother was the model of writing. I repeat these scenes of instruction of listening to my father tell stories and watching my mother write and then watching her read her writing in public at these funerals. And at the minutes when she was the first colored secretary of the Piedmont PTA. But they viewed my brother and me and our relationship, the relationship among the four of us, as a tight little world. My mother alienated herself from her family, from her nine brothers and her two sisters, and my father basically did the same thing by choosing to raise us as equals. We had to be reverent. I mean, Lord knows we had to be respectful, and we were punished if they thought that we weren't. But they treated us like adults in that they let us in on family secrets, in on, you know, who was doing what in town, in on their innermost doubts and fears. And they rewarded us when we, well, not exactly when we were defiant, but when we were properly independent. And I mean by that, that if we took a stand, which they didn't agree with or they didn't even understand, they were willing to play it out if we insisted, as long as we wouldn't harm ourselves or get ourselves in trouble. Of course, we had to suffer the consequences if it was a mistake. But my wife and I have tried to use a similar method of raising children for our own two daughters, who are now 12 and 14, so that we were always in trouble with my aunts and uncles, particularly in the Coleman family. I mean, they always said, that boy's got too much mouth. And they were probably right. But the point is, I knew I could always run back to my mother, and she would always defend me, and that was good. I had a lot of practice doing battle with my aunts and uncles, and I think that that prepared me to do, if you can survive Piedmont with the Coleman family, the black Muslims are a piece of cake.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's great being back on your show.
Henry Louis Gates has written a new memoir called Colored People. He chairs Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the folk, grunge, hip-hop music of the singer-songwriter Beck. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade. Just a year and a half ago, he was working at a video store. Now he's got a hit song about being a loser. Also, the MTV generation has discovered a singer that belongs to their parents' or grandparents' generation. TV critic David Bianculli tells us about the new MTV Unplugged concert featuring Tony Bennett. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House Ways and Means Committee is going about its business despite numerous indictments lodged against Chairman Dan Rostenkowski. Democrat Sam Gibbons of Florida has become acting chairman. He's already ordered the committee staff to prepare a draft health care bill. Gibbons says he's not worried about guiding the committee in the right direction. He's told the Washington Post that he favors requiring employers to help pay for their workers' health insurance, and he says he supports including abortion coverage in the standard package of health benefits. President Clinton made an appeal today on French radio for France to keep its peacekeeping troops in Bosnia. Paris has been threatening to withdraw its troops from Bosnia if no progress is made in peace talks. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Clinton said he understands that France does not want to be caught in the middle of the fighting in Bosnia, but he said he hopes French troops will stay in the Balkans until all possibilities for a settlement have been exhausted. The French government has warned that if the Bosnian Croats, Muslims, and Serbs don't reach a settlement, that France will pull its troops out. It has the largest contingent in the former Yugoslavia, almost 7,000 troops. Clinton said he thinks there's a chance that the warring factions will realize that they could continue fighting well into the next century and still not resolve their problems on the battlefield. He also said it's important not to impose an artificial opportunity on the Bosnians. France has been pushing the United States to try to force the Bosnian Muslims to stop fighting. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The United Nations has released its 1994 Human Development Report. The paper asks where the savings from cuts in military spending are going. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The report says nations have cut their military spending 3.6% annually since 1987. But the nearly $1 trillion peace dividend has been spent without diverting much of it to social spending. The study also finds that developing countries spend nearly $150 billion a year on arms, and the five permanent Security Council members supply 86% of the weapons to them. The report also notes that in third world countries, the chances of dying from social neglect is 33 times greater than dying in an armed conflict with another country. The Human Development Report calls for phasing out military assistance programs and tying aid to reduced military budgets. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The UN has resumed food deliveries to Kigali, Rwanda. The relief operation was suspended yesterday after a peacekeeper was killed by mortar fire. On Wall Street, stock prices recovered today from a big early sell-off to finish slightly higher. The Dow Jones Industrials closed 2.5 points higher at 3,760. This is NPR. A third wave of blue flu has swept the Los Angeles Police Department. L.A. Mayor Richard Reardon is asking the officers to accept mediation to break a contract dispute. 458 officers and sergeants were scheduled to work today, and 256 called in sick. Officers from yesterday's evening shift were held for 16-hour double shifts. The sick-out began on Monday. Contract talks have been on and off for 2 years. The city's been reluctant to give officers more money because of budget constraints. The United States is putting up 55,000 resident visas in a lottery for foreigners. Applications have to be in by June 30th. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
The government begins accepting the lottery entries today by mail at 6 addresses in New Hampshire. The State Department has already discarded more than 10,000 applications because they arrived before the opening of the lottery period. Winners are required to have a high school diploma or its equivalent, or have worked for at least 2 years at a skilled occupation. The program favors Africa and most of Europe, including the former Soviet Union. Those regions get 4 out of 5 of the visas. The lottery is intended to encourage diversity among aliens settling in the U.S. Some potential immigrants are barred from the lottery because 50,000 or more people from those countries have entered the U.S. in the past 5 years. Those countries include China, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, and the United Kingdom, excluding Northern Ireland. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
The federal government wants to make sure that airplanes don't follow too closely behind Boeing 757s. The Federal Aviation Administration says starting July 1st, aircraft following 757s must stay at least 4 nautical miles behind. The current limit is 3 miles. The problem is turbulent winds in the 757's wake that have been blamed in several incident crashes. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A popular refrain on MTV goes, "I'm a loser, baby, so why don't you kill me?" It's the chorus of a grunge rap by the 23-year-old singer-songwriter Beck. His video has been in heavy rotation, but just a year and a half ago, he was working at a video store in an L.A. mini mall. Loser is featured on Beck's new CD, Mellow Gold.
In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. Butane in my veins and mouth to cut the chuggy with the plastic eye. Spray paint the vegetables, dog food skulls with the beefcake pantyhose. Kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with a loser in the cruise control. Babies in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches, sleep on the love seat. Someone came saying I'm insane to complain about a shotgun wedding and a stain on my shirt. Don't believe everything that you breathe. You get a parking violation and a maggot on your sleeve. So shave your face with some mace in the dark.
Beck has been influenced not just by rap and grunge, but by blues and folk music. Beck started listening to folk music as a teenager. I asked him if it related to his life.
I liked it because it was, you know, direct and straightforward. And I always liked that in music, and it was raw. I was always interested in music and stuff, and I was really into punk rock and noise and stuff. You know, music where you just sort of get up and do it. And it seemed like folk music was something you could just pick up and just do. You know, you didn't need electricity or anything.
You grew up with your grandfather in Kansas City and with your mother in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. During which parts of your life were you in which place?
I was kind of back and forth a lot. I probably was in Kansas till I was about 12, and then I spent teenage time in L.A.
Your grandfather was a Presbyterian preacher.
Right.
Was there music in your grandfather's church that affected you one way or another?
I'm really into, you know, Delta blues, gospel music. That music really struck me when I first heard it. And I do some of those type songs, old gospel songs, but taken to, you know, a much more minimal sort of spooky place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the, you know, the blues that Skip James or Willie McTell.
When you were trying to learn what you'd heard on records and stuff, what did you think of yourself as a straight blues singer before you started doing your take on that form of music?
Yeah, I never really thought about it. I just like the music, and I played the songs in my own way. You know, they're just songs. I wasn't trying to reproduce any style or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, at the same time, I wasn't pretending I was some downtrodden
Delta guy.
Down in Mississippi. You know, trying, you know, struggling along. You know. I was just, you know, they're just songs, and they have a certain beauty and richness that attracted me.
When did you start realizing that you could do your version of blues songs? That you could take what you liked about it and then add things that were more contemporary and more your sensibility, and by that I mean more your kind of ironic take on things.
I don't really remember. I guess I was just sort of always doing that. I would always, you know, take one of these old songs and just make up my own lyrics to them and stuff. A lot of times, because I couldn't understand what the singer was saying, sometimes they, you know, the singer, someone like Blind Willie Johnson, he's just sort of opening his throat and shredding it. You know, he can't really hear what he's saying. So I would just make up my own words.
My guest is singer-songwriter Beck. His new album is called Mellow Gold. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer-songwriter Beck. Now, you dropped out of school in ninth grade. What made you decide to leave?
I guess all I can remember is I was feeling sort of like I wasn't, you know, going anywhere. I wasn't learning anything. And I remember just getting up in English class one day and just leaving, you know. And I went home, and then after a few weeks, my mom noticed. She said, "You're not going to school." And I said, "Yeah, I don't really like it, you know." And so I took some test or something, and that was it.
What kind of
test? Got a job.
What kind of test did you take?
I don't even remember. Just some thing that says, "Okay, you're okay. You can leave school. We won't arrest you."
So how did you support yourself afterwards?
And
what did you do with your time?
Oh, I had lots of, you know, just running around cleaning up jobs and nothing too important. I just make money to, you know, put gas in the car and stuff like that, and I just play music. And then after a while, I just I saw this commercial on TV. A Greyhound had this $60 ticket to go across America. So I just went over to New York and started hanging out there.
So what changed when you went to New York?
I guess I moved to the Lower East Side, and there was people hanging out in the street playing music, and there was different bars where you could just get up on stage and play, and just kind of people, you know, if you were standing around with a guitar, you know, next thing you knew, you were up on a stage playing for three people, and you know, it was sort of funny. It was a really small little scene, you know, people playing for other musicians and stuff, but it kind of got me to start doing it, getting up there.
So what kind of material would you do? Would you do your songs?
I guess I did a lot of old Woody Guthrie and some Delta blues.
And how did you first end up with music on the radio?
I met these guys who were doing a label. I said that I was interested in rap music. I'd rap to my acoustic guitar. And one of the guys said, yeah, I know this kid who does drum beats and stuff. So I went over to his house, and he had a little reel-to-reel tape machine in his living room. And I started playing the lick and Loser, the slide thing, and we threw that onto a drum beat, and then they had the drums blasting, and I just wrote out this rap and rapped it, and the rap sounded so bad, so I just said, you know, I'm a loser, really bad rapper. And then I didn't hear the song for about a year. And then these friends of mine who were doing that label decided to put it out. And that was about the beginning of last year. They just put out 400 copies. And I guess it sort of made its way, kind of took on a life of its own.
So is everybody saying to you now that you're on a major label and you got a couple of videos, it's so ironic mm-hmm. that your big hit is I'm a Loser.
It's hilarious.
And now, so what does that mean to you? Does it mean anything to you?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, the song sort of had this novelty thing, and it was popular on the college radio and in L.A. and California and stuff. And then I thought it was going to go away. I mean, and then it started just all of a sudden these commercial radio stations were playing it, and there was only 400 copies of it. I mean, they were taping each other's copies of the vinyl and playing that on the radio. You know, they couldn't even get it. So, you know, after that, at that point, you know, I just figured that would sort of be it. And then I had the record pretty much recorded, you know, by last spring. And it finally came out this year, and I thought it would just sort of fade away. But it seems, I guess, people are listening to it.
So you had like 400 copies of Loser that made its way onto some radio stations. People were making copies of copies. Where did Geffen enter the picture?
I guess they had heard it a while back, and I met with somebody there, and it was sort of funny, you know, and then I just figured that'd be it, and then they kept being interested, and I kept, for I guess about 6 or 7 months, I just sort of kept my distance. I just wanted to do my own thing. I didn't want to get you know, plugged into a big system or something. But, you know, eventually it came to the point where they said, well, you know, you just do what you want, you know, we're not going to tell you what to do, and, you know, you know, we just want to put it out. So I said, okay.
Well, you have a song that you recorded again. This is on just a promotional cassette. It's not on the new CD, but it's called MTV, and the lyric is about MTV makes me want to smoke crack. Tell me about writing this one.
That's a really old one. That one's from when I was hanging out in New York about 5 years ago. And we would just hang out and drink and just make up songs and sort of trade songs, you know, me and a couple other guys just, you know, killing time and stuff. And that was just, you know, stream of consciousness, sort of, kind of, I don't know, sort of a little bit Weird Al Yankovic or something.
Mm-hmm. Well,
It was meant to be a punk rock folk song.
About MTV.
Yeah.
Bringing in a little bit of everything. So this is Beck from a promotional cassette, basically. This was recorded on KCRW's program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, with host Chris Derides.
Everything's perky and everything's so bright. Everything's so slick and everyone's uptight. Pictures are nice, the colors are nice, the girls are nice, and everything's so nice. MTV makes me wanna smoke crack. I love you. wait. Hold the show. Gonna bum rush this. You know, singing this song like that, I just gotta admit that I spent the last week making a video myself. So, could you hit that tape? I think we gotta do this another way.
Hey!
Get busy. MTV makes me want to smoke crack. Whoa! Fly out the window, and I'm never coming back. MTV makes me want to get high as the moon, like a rubber balloon.
Do you feel that you can sing MTV anymore?
I've done it a few times. I can do the lounge version with a straight face, I guess.
Now we've been talking about the kind of ironic side of your music, but you actually have a CD coming out soon. Tell me what's going to be on the CD.
Just a lot of songs that a lot of quieter sort of. I don't know, I guess you could sort of say love songs, some old gospel type Delta blues, finger picking, more country type stuff.
You know, I have found that a lot of people who are very ironic as singers or songwriters or performers sometimes can't quit being ironic. They can't sing a love song or, you know, just a song with serious sentiment to it. Is it ever hard for you to switch gears from irony to you know, serious sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I don't know, like more, you know, less ironic stuff. It's easy to in this day and age to be ironic and cynical and stuff. I think it's a lot harder to be, you know, just real, you know, not putting on any airs of, I know too much to have, you know, those kind of feelings.
Beck's new CD, Mellow Gold, is on Geffen Records. His forthcoming independent label CD is called One Foot in the Grave. From it, this is He's a Mighty Good Leader.
He's a mighty good leader. He's a mighty good leader. He's a mighty good leader. All the way, all the way, Lord, from up to heaven. He's a mighty good leader. All the way.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tom Jelton reports from Sarajevo. Leaders have been chosen for the new Bosnian alliance with Croatia. Laura Ziegler reports on new figures showing the U.S. prison population is at a record high. Jim Zarola reports on the complaints from states around the country that there's a rise in crime committed by immigrants. The states are asking the federal government for help. Linda Wertheimer talks with visitors to Washington about the indictment yesterday of Congressman Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois. And I'll speak with Beryl Bainbridge, author of a book called The Birthday Boys, the story of the 1912 British expedition to the South Pole.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. MTV's acoustic concert series, Unplugged, has presented unamplified performances by rock, heavy metal, and rap performers like Eric Clapton, R.E.M., Aerosmith, and Arrested Development. Tonight, Unplugged devotes an hour to an uncharacteristic choice, singer Tony Bennett. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
You are beautiful! Take you guys on the road. That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Look, I'm all for MTV expanding its horizons and its playlist.
And before anybody accuses me of not appreciating the songs and singers of the past, let me shoot that one down right away. Based on what I load in my CD player, I'm already a partial old fogey. I listen to Sinatra as well as Sting, and Bix Beiderbecke as well as the Beatles. But Tony Bennett? I don't want to be the one to say the Emperor has no microphone, but why the sudden fuss about Tony Bennett? Yes, he's shown up as a character on The Simpsons, but Mel Torme was celebrated for years on Night Court and even made a few guest appearances. So why Tony Bennett and not Mel Torme? For that matter, if the newest MTV generation is going to acknowledge a veteran crooner, why not Lena Horne? The answer, I guess, is that Bennett has been successful at reaching out to new listeners without changing his old style. He's got a video on MTV, he's performed in rock clubs on the same bill as Cowboy Junkies, and his last few albums are aiming at and hitting a wider demographic. What Bennett brings to the table and to MTV is a track record, a certain history and assurance, and his signature tune, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. Where he left his voice is another question. It's pleasant, but it's not what it was. And to me, what it was wasn't all that impressive.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found that somebody who...
The show is mostly Bennett backed by a jazz trio, but he does make room for duets with two different guest stars. Elvis Costello teams with Bennett for They Can't Take That Away From Me, but their voices and styles don't really blend. And K.D. Lang joins Bennett for a version of Moonglow that's the program's one highlight, the one time everything works and sounds truly beautiful.
It must have been Moonglow. Way up in the blue, it must have been moon glow that led me straight to you. I still hear you say, dear one, hold me fast.
Embracing the music of the past is a great idea, even if it's not a new one. Before Bono and Company did duets with Frank Sinatra in the 90s, Linda Ronstadt recorded a collection of standards in the 80s, and Harry Nilsson did one in the early 70s. So did Ringo Starr, but that didn't help much. A singer as good as K.D. Lang deserves her own show, and she's gotten it, but so far only on MTV's conservative sister station, VH1. If someone can explain to me why Lang is relegated to VH1, while Bennett gets the full MTV treatment, I'm willing to listen. Meanwhile, I'm baffled.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Cherry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.